I'm Marek Kakula, I'm the public astronomer at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, and I'm standing on the prime meridian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly, and I'm not Alok Jar either. On this week's podcast, 2009 is the International Year of Astronomy. It's only taken us 9 months to get round to it, but here's our dedicated podcast on all things space.
They were asteroids that were wandering past and captured, so maybe this planet was captured in some sort of encounter.
We dial up Israel to discuss dark energy with Professor Ofer Lahav.
A variant of what we call today dark energy appears in Newton's Principia, 320 years ago.
Plus, as you heard a moment ago, a historical look as we visit the centre of the universe, well, as far as space and time is concerned.
The Royal Observatory is a unique place. It's the place from which time and distance are measured, so it's the zero point for the longitude system.
And she may not have had that much interest in space, but the oldest ever human ancestor has been unearthed. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, I'm Nell Bowes. I'm helping to keep things on track while Alok is away. With me in the studio is Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample.
Hello.
Hello, Ian. And also here is our astrophysicist for today's proceedings, Dr. Chris Lintott.
Hello.
Hello, Chris. Chris is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oxford, and you might also know him as the co-presenter of the BBC's The Sky at Night, alongside Patrick Moore. How are things going on The Sky at Night at the moment?
Fantastically. This month's programme is a little cursed. We keep having to reshoot things because people keep discovering exciting things. It's been one of those months with water on the moon and Mars, extrasolar planets. The only thing that could go wrong now is a bright comet sometime in the next few days.
So you're keeping your fingers crossed that we're not going to discover anything else.
Yes, we need everyone to take the next week off, please.
Tell us a bit about some of the things that have come up in the past month. It's been a good month for extrasolar planets, it seems.
Yes, these days it almost seems that it's
one a week.
It's a good month, week for extrasolar planets all the time. It's hard to remember that we only discovered the first one, the first planet around another star, back in, when was it, 1995. And suddenly we have hundreds of the things. But I think there have been a few good ones recently. One of my favourites was discovered by this beautifully low-tech, straightforward British collaboration called WASP.
So what are WASP? How did they arise? What do they do?
WASPs, actually, they're super WASP these days. But the original WASP was a desperate effort to get some publicity for a telescope in La Palma. And when anything bright happens in the sky, something spectacular like Comet Hale-Bopp that came round in the late 90s, people expect us professional astronomers to have a good view of it. And most professional astronomers couldn't tell you a comet if it knocked on their door and wandered in for a cup of tea. But nonetheless, they wanted to take a picture of the comet, so they took a proper observatory-class camera and then a lens off somebody's digital camera and put them together, pointed them at the sky, and got this beautiful image of the comet with lots of stars in the background. And then they realised that if you want to find planets, you've got to monitor lots of stars at once. And so they've built a whole array of these things. They even bought some of the lenses off eBay, would you believe, to make sure everything fitted together properly. And WASP is scanning the sky, monitoring hundreds of thousands of stars for the sign of planets. And they found a particularly unusual one just a few weeks ago.
So the idea here is that you're just getting as many stars as possible in your field of vision.
That's right. And you keep an eye on any of them in case they blink. Because if they blink, if they dip in brightness just for a short period of time, you can perhaps conclude that a planet has passed in front of the star as seen from Earth. And then we can work out the properties of that planet by looking at the length of time it takes to blink. That gives you the orbit and the amount of time it takes to decay from full brightness to the bottom of the eclipse. And that gives you the size of the planet. So it's a fantastic way to find planets. And WASP is up to, I think this was their 17th, this recent discovery.
And so what are the weirdest ones that they've found?
Well, this is the weirdest one because it's going backwards. So if you think about our solar system, you have the sun at the centre rotating and all the planets orbiting in the same direction. There's sort of a natural spin to the solar system, which is inherited from the disk of material that we think the planets formed out of originally.
And this can be either way, but
that's
it's
right,
just
but it should be
they're
consistent.
All going in the same
Whereas
direction.
Whereas this planet's going backwards compared to its star. Now, I think this is, you know, they announced the discovery and people have been scrambling ever since, but the kind of thing you might be talking about here is the effect of some sort of disruption to the disk. Maybe there's another planet in the system further out that really, something much bigger than Jupiter might have screwed up the dynamics of the disk and caused something odd to happen. Maybe this planet's been pinched
from another system. When we see some of the moons in the outer solar system, a couple of the moons of the outer planets rotate in the opposite direction. And there we think they've been stolen. They were asteroids that were wandering past and captured. So maybe this planet was captured in some sort of encounter. I think it just gives us a sense of how weird other solar systems are. They're not all like ours. We don't have neat rocky planets near the star and then big gas giants and little Guardian reporters and podcasters sitting on the third planet out. You know, we have a whole zoo of different solar systems out there.
And why are we, why are extrasolar planets interesting? Why are we basically looking for another Earth?
We're definitely looking for another Earth. That's the Holy Grail. But what's amazing is how close we are to that. So, for example, just in the last few weeks, some studies of a planet we knew existed, Corot 7b, and I apologise for the name. Astronomers shouldn't be allowed to name anything. Let's call it. You can invent your own names at home.
Donald Duck.
Donald Duck, yeah, there we go. Corot 7b, otherwise known as Donald Duck, is the first planet that we know has a rocky surface. So it's got 5 times the amount of matter that Earth has in only twice the volume, or twice the radius, in fact. So it must have a rocky surface. So you could go there and stand on it. Next thing we need is an Earth in a sensible orbit. Donald Duck is too close to the star. It's very, very hot. So we need something a bit further out. And then in just a few years' time, we'll have telescopes capable of telling us about the atmosphere of those planets. And there we might see oxygen in the atmosphere. And if you see that, you know there's some sort of biological process.
The whole hunt for the second Earth is something that I find incredibly exciting and just one of these genuinely wonderful things that is going on. But there's another aspect of it that profoundly depresses me, and there's something of the prism visit about it. I mean, if we, in 5 years' time, if we hear from one of the new sort of orbiting telescopes that people have found a rocky planet in the habitable zone where temperatures are within the realms of, you know, supporting liquid water. We know it's rocky, it's in the right place. Atmospheric sensors suggest that it has water in the atmosphere. It's going to be far too far away for us to send anything there within probably humanity's lifetime. And it's just, there's this barrier which we can't reach across, and it's wonderful. They must be out there, in my view, but it's wonderful that I, you know, presumably we will find them in our lifetimes, but we won't be able to get any more unless we can actually look down on the planet.
Well, I think there's two things there. One is that the first thing is that we need to answer the scientific question, are they out there? And that's becoming something we can test. And frankly, in some senses, it's surprising we haven't been contacted by aliens. You know, if we're here, surely we're not the only intelligent podcasting life around in the near universe. So one way you can get out of that conundrum is to say, well, life isn't common. It's very hard for life to start. So we need to find some other rocky planets and see whether they have atmospheres that are indicative of life. And secondly, I'm not sure it is that outlandish to suggest that we might one day visit these things. I mean, I think knowing that there's a planet with the signs of life on will be an immense spur to developing systems to communicate and get us there. There's always the fundamental speed of light limit. But I'm not sure it's any more outlandish than, say, Galileo suggesting we might walk on the moon. So I think give us a few hundred years and the knowledge of where we're going and we might surprise you.
But Corot 7b must be tens of millions of light years away.
It's not that far, and most of these planets are pretty close. I mean, you'd expect a lot of planets within 50 to 100 light years. So that's close enough that they'd be watching our television, which is a bit terrifying.
Maybe that's the solution to why they're just keeping very quiet.
So, Chris, tell me a bit more about what you're actually working on at the moment, because you're not extrasolar planets, you're more galaxy formation. That's where your kind of bag at the moment, isn't it?
That's right. I've been horribly distracted by galaxies, and in particular by a project I run called Galaxy Zoo. In fact, galaxyzoo.org, if I can get the plug in, which has recruited about 250,000 volunteers to help us sort through about 1 million images of galaxies. And they found all sorts of things. My favourite recently have been a set of galaxies which our users call the Galaxy Zoo Peas. And they're called the peas because they're small, round, and green.
Are they really green?
They appear green in the images. It's actually an emission from oxygen.
Right.
And that's the crucial point, because the strength of that emission tells us that these things are forming a lot of stars. They're small galaxies. They're about 100 times smaller than the Milky Way. But they're forming stars at a ridiculous rate. In fact, they're the most efficient producers of stars anywhere in the local universe. And we only know to look at them because a whole host of Galaxy Zoo volunteers looked through the data, spotted these things in the background. The computer thought they were stars because they're just small and round. But they spotted these things, they collected them, they made an awful lot of terrible jokes about peas on our discussion board. And then they came to us with 200 of these things and insisted that we find out what they are. So what we think is happening is these are the remnants of a type of star formation that was common a long time ago. So most of the stars in the universe formed a few billion years ago. In fact, the bad news is our universe is long past its peak. There are more stars dying now than are being born. But back then, galaxies very quickly converted lots of their stars, lots of their gas into stars. And these days, things are a bit more sedate. The Milky Way turns one sun's worth of gas into stars every year, which sounds like a lot, but spread over the galaxy is not hugely significant. Whereas these things are still rushing away. So we think by studying them, we can get a handle on what happened in the early universe. It's absolutely fascinating.
It's quite interesting that you're actually managing to sort of crowdsource this stuff, that people, not experts, amateurs, can have a look and actually find stuff. What's the underlying data that you're using, and is it... is it being updated constantly, or is it...
Well, not for the main project. We have a data set from what's called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is a robotic telescope in New Mexico that scanned the sky looking for galaxies for about 7 years, and they took images of a million of them. And the first task we needed was to work out what shape these galaxies are. There's a huge difference between spiral galaxies, you know, the pretty ones that everyone's familiar with, and big balls of stars that we call elliptical. But dividing them is a task for the human eye. We tried giving it to a student. He told me where to stick it after 50,000 galaxies. And it turns out the public are actually better at this than the professionals. So that's the task.
You seem to have a sort of top Trump system of galaxy wars going on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes. We should actually market the top Trumps, I think. But yeah, so if your galaxy is a spiral, then we immediately ask you to rank it against another spiral and tell us which is the spiraliest. I think that's English. And the idea there is people have always sorted galaxies into discrete categories. They've always said this is a type SA3, whatever it is, spiral. And we're not sure these categories mean anything. We think if you sort them all out in order, you see a nice continuum of spiraliness. So that's what we're aiming at there. But this works really well. It's a really good way to get to deal with big data sets. We're overwhelmed by the number of galaxies we can image. We needed some help.
Chris, can I ask you something that constantly come across when you're writing about universes as a journalist, but I have to say I don't understand at all. And it's this idea that the universe is flat, and it suggests that it's 2D, planar, you know, a sheet of paper. And I don't know what it means. Is that something that you can help me out with?
Sure. What we're talking about here is the amount of energy in the universe. And instead of thinking of it as like a piece of paper, what this means is your maths teacher was right in that the geometry that we're used to holds throughout the universe. So you probably learnt in school, I hope you're going to nod at me, that angles in a triangle add up to 180 degrees, yes? Well, that's not always true. If you imagine starting at the North Pole, walking down to the equator, turn left, walk a bit along the equator, and then walk back to the North Pole, you've got two right angle turns, and then an angle at the top when you compare your tracks in the snow. And so that adds up to more than 180 degrees because you're on a sphere. So the universe on a whole could have that kind of geometry, or it could have something more bizarre. But in fact, your maths teacher's right, normal geometry holds. If you fire two light beams into the universe that are parallel, they will remain the same distance apart forever, whereas in other geometries they might diverge or converge. So that's what we're talking about. The importance of this is that it tells us how much energy there is in the universe, and we don't see enough stuff to account for that. In fact, all the normal matter in the universe adds up to about 5% of the critical value, and the rest of it's dark matter and dark energy. And if you want to know what those are, you have to ask somebody a lot more intelligent than I am, or a lot more senior, at least.
Well, I think we're going to get Ofer Lahav on, so we can get both of you on the dark energy topic to clarify it in a second. I wanted to ask you one last thing in this, kind of as you're explaining these ideas and these concepts. I noticed on your blog you mentioned popular science as an odd term.
Oh, yeah, this is...
You'd have something against popular science.
Well, it suggests that there's such a thing as unpopular science. And I don't... I think there's a whole host of these terms. For example, when I'm talking to my university colleagues about what I spend a lot of my time doing, you fall into calling it outreach, which sounds like some sort of community
project
for poor, deprived non-scientists. So I think a lot of these terms, and popular science is one of these, suggests that the scientist has come down from his ivory tower with the tablet on which the rules of the universe is written, and then you read them out to the populace who give you a Nobel Prize. And actually, that's not... A, we don't have a tablet with the rules of the universe on. B, the best thing about science is when people disagree and argue and the process that leads us to science. So rather than having popular science and outreach, we have this, we call Galaxy Zoo citizen science, which comes with its own pretentious bag of tricks. But it's this idea that science is something that people should follow, like you follow a football team.
So that everybody should get involved.
Yeah, exactly. And take an interest in it as it's happening, rather than waiting for the ivory tower and the flash of light and the big tablet of rules of the universe.
That's great, Chris. Thank you. We'll come back to you at the end of the programme to discuss dark energy and LCROSS, the space probe that is going to smash into the moon on Friday. Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. Here's Ian and producer Andy.
News Jack.
The oldest potential ancestor of a human being has been uncovered in Ethiopia. The remains of a female called Adi give the clearest picture yet of the origin of our species. The partial skeleton shows she walked on two legs, but was adept at climbing trees and moving through the forest canopy. All this happened some 4.4 million years ago. Experts are describing the find as the most important regarding human evolution in the past century.
Students are increasingly using brain-boosting drugs to boost their performance. A psychology study at the University of Sydney shows drugs normally used for conditions such as Alzheimer's disease and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder are being used by students around the world to improve their academic performance. The author says the argument for banning these drugs for non-medical use because they offer some students an unfair advantage is like suggesting private tuition be banned. They may even level the playing field for those who have been disadvantaged.
Babies being born right now are likely to live to 100. Experts say if current trends continue, life expectancy is increasing so fast that half the babies born in 2007 will live to be at least 103, while half the babies born in Japan in the same year will reach the age of 107. Despite having more chronic illnesses such as cancers and heart conditions, people are surviving them because they are diagnosed earlier and get better treatment. Aging populations pose severe challenges for the traditional social welfare state.
And the annual Ig Nobel Awards have taken place at Harvard University, a celebration of research that cannot or should not be repeated. Here are some of the highlights. Naming cows Daisy increases their milk yield. A bra that can be converted into a pair of gas masks. Work on turning tequila into diamonds, and why pregnant women don't topple over.
Okie doke, interesting use of physics there. Ian, tell us a bit more about Adi. Why is she so important?
Adi is potentially incredibly important because she is, or her skeleton is, the oldest that we have of a potential human ancestor. I mean, there are fragments of older probable human ancestors going up to even 7 million years, although to be fair you could say that they are the common ancestor we shared with the line that eventually turned into chimpanzees, modern chimpanzees. We may have diverged as early as 6 million years ago, but Adi is a good collection of fossilized bones. You have the skull, the pelvis, crucially for working out whether she walked upright or not, ankle bones, which also tell you a lot about that, hand bones, and there's just an awful lot in there. 4.4 million years old, which takes us further back than the Lucy fossil, which was found in 1974, 3.2 million years old, in actually a higher level of the sediments in Ethiopia than this one was found. It pushes us back more towards this shared common ancestor that we had when basically the evolutionary past diverged between us and the line that turned into chimps. I mean, what's interesting about this in a way is it gets us closer to where we first came from. But there is a kind of a strange human hubris, if you like, that we have evolved a hell of a lot since then, but chimps haven't, or what became chimps haven't. And if you think, I mean, for some reason, we seem to think that we came from chimps, essentially, or something like chimps. There's no reason to think that. There's something very sort of human-centric about that idea. I mean, chimps have very probably evolved just as much as we have. And this fossil shows that. Some of the bone morphologies and the biomechanics of this creature are far more primitive than modern chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are very specialized. We now know, and I think that is just there's some hugely interesting stuff in that.
Now, from the sublime to the ridiculous, so we can't go through this week without mentioning the Ig Nobels that were announced on Thursday. And I was just wondering, Chris, do you have a favourite amongst them?
For experiment design, because I always think as an astronomer we have trouble looking back and planning over the timescales. But the prize for medicine, I think, this year is fantastic. This went to somebody who wanted to know, inspired by his mother, who told him that if you crack your knuckles, you'll get arthritis. So for 60 years, this chap, he's now 80-something, has been cracking the knuckles only on his left hand. And so I think that's fantastic, to have the perseverance to push forward. It raises other questions. One is, has he got arthritis in either hand? I don't know what the result is. And secondly, one person isn't much of a trial. So I want everyone listening to pick a hand, and left or right, and then email in 60 years' time. And we'll see what the results are.
Yeah, well, I have to say he hasn't got arthritis. And so he said when he looked at his hands and saw no signs of arthritis, he looked to the heavens and he said, "Mother, you were wrong, you were wrong, you were wrong." He said, "Now I'm telling you this, it sounds really odd." And I said, "It's taken you 60 years to appreciate how odd it is, the thing you've been doing." Anyway, my favourite, it's a hard call actually this year, but I think I'm going to have to go with the Ig Nobel Peace Prize, which was done by a group at the University of Bern in Switzerland, who were interested in finding out whether it was better to be clubbed by a full beer bottle or an empty beer bottle. And I was looking through their paper yesterday, and it wasn't as conclusive as you'd hope. I mean, both are pretty bad, and can be wielded with enough sort of force to break your skull. So it's fairly and literally
sort
academic which one's better, but there were differences obviously in momentum and things like this. But
it's a classic example of them missing the point. If it's a full beer bottle, not only do you have a sore head, but
you've
wasted
the
beer. So it's trivial.
If you hit yourself with your beer, yes, that's true.
Well, brilliant. For everything you need to know about these stories, including an interview with paleontologist Tim White about Ardi, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
I'm Professor Michio Kaku, and you're listening to Science Weekly.
In October, the Royal Observatory in Greenwich celebrates 125 years of standing on the prime meridian of the world. It's one of the world's oldest and most famous historic scientific sites, and it's also the centre for standardised timekeeping. Sorry about that, Paris. We went along and set our microphone up, straddling that famous shiny metal line that dissects London and beyond.
I'm Marek Kakula, I'm the public astronomer at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, and I'm standing on the prime meridian. Many, many countries had their own meridians that they were using for maps and for navigation, and it was starting to get very confusing. And as the world became a more integrated place and travel and commerce were becoming more and more important, it was realised that everybody needed to agree on one system that they all used and that all the maps used. So there was a big conference in Washington, D.C. in October 1884, and a lot of argument and debate. Obviously, many countries wanted their own meridian to be chosen, but because the Greenwich Meridian was already used in the majority of maritime maps around the world, it was decided that it would just be easier and less hassle for everybody to use Greenwich. And so that's how it became the prime meridian for the world. We're standing now in the dome of the 28-inch telescope here at the observatory. It's a 19th century instrument, and it really was the Hubble Space Telescope of its day. This particular telescope is very good for looking at things like the moon, and in fact the magnification is so great that when you look at the moon you only see a tiny part of the surface, craters and mountains, because it just looks so big at that magnification. You can also see things like Jupiter, and you'll be able to see the moons of Jupiter, just as Galileo did 400 years ago, although slightly better view than he would have had. And the rings of Saturn, and we can even see things like Neptune and Uranus on a good night. I'm standing in front of the cone, which covers the roof of our planetarium. It opened in 2007. That's the only planetarium in London. Now the one at Madame Tussauds has closed. The cone itself, which covers the roof of the planetarium, is made of 45 tons of bronze, and it's a really cool sort of space age structure, which I think really nicely complements the older telescope domes here on site. It's designed specifically for the site here at Greenwich. It's aligned with the meridian line north-south, but the slope of the cone is 51.5 degrees, which means that if you lean against the cone on a cold winter's night and stare right up, you'll see twinkling at the top the pole star Polaris, because the cone actually slopes right up to the north pole of the sky. I think we're living in a very exciting time for astronomy. It's 400 years since Galileo's first observations through a telescope. There are many, many new telescopes coming on stream, many new spacecraft, and we're starting to answer some really exciting questions about the universe. Because in the last few years, we've been getting really exciting data back from all of these space probes orbiting Mars and on the surface of Mars, and which are telling us a lot about the wet history of that planet, and how certainly there was a lot of water there in the past, but also that there seems to be quite a lot of water still there, locked up in the form of ice, quite close beneath the surface of the soil. So this is really exciting news, because it tells us Mars was a wet world in the past, and that also if there's water around under the soil, if any life did form on Mars, there's a chance that it may still be surviving deep down where there are pockets of liquid water. So it's a very exciting time for Mars scientists as well.
For more information about the observatory, click on nmm.ac.uk. And if you want to have a tour around the Royal Observatory without even leaving your desk, have a look at what we filmed there, including some astrolabes, 28-inch refracting telescope, and the strange copper planetarium tower. It's all at guardian.co.uk/video.
Science Weekly.
Right, switch your brains on. We couldn't get through this podcast without talking about dark energy, one of our favourite matters. It's only hypothetical, but permeates all of space. It's also used to explain why the universe appears to be expanding at an accelerating rate. But some scientists have recently questioned its existence. Instead of me trying to explain, let's talk to someone who really knows his stuff. Professor Ofer Lahav is Head of Astrophysics and Perrin Chair of Astronomy at University College London. In a podcast first, he's on the line, live-ish, well, right now. Hello, Ofer.
Hello.
Hi, nice to talk to you. I believe you're in Israel at the moment.
That's correct. I'm on a sabbatical term here.
Tell us in simple terms, what is dark energy?
Well, it's an unexplained component in our universe. The name dark energy is relatively modern, about 10 years old or so, but the concept itself goes back to Einstein's theory of relativity, where, if you like, a variant of dark energy was called, named by Einstein, the cosmological constant. I would even argue, and that's a somewhat less known fact, that a variant of what we call today dark energy appears in Newton's Principia 320 years ago. So for some of us, the problem is 10-year-old, that for others it's 90-year-old, and for others it's 320 years old.
What's the bit in Principia that's the dark energy?
Newton talks about two possible forces in our world. One is we know as the 1/r² law, which is fully accepted and is taught, you know, in schools, and that's how we manage to get in airplanes and arrive safely, by trusting that this is the correct law of gravity. But he also makes a somewhat a parenthetical remark on another possible force, which is linear with distance. So rather than the force dropping like the inverse of the distance, this other force actually is linear with distance. Interestingly enough, the most modern theories and observations of the universe, if you translate them into the Newtonian limit, actually do talk about a linear force, and that's exactly what dark energy does. It's, if you like, it's a repulsive force, while the inverse squared law pulls us, the linear term pushes us away. So through a very different reasoning, it appears in Newton's Principia. But of course, he didn't call it dark energy.
I noticed that recently a couple of mathematicians in America have come up with a way of accounting for the universe without resorting to dark energy. Is this the kind of thing that you see a lot, or is this a breakthrough?
Yeah, we see, I'm aware of this paper, and we see kind of various papers that, broadly speaking, going that route. So to put it in context, the problem we have is if we look at current observations, and I'm talking about four or five different techniques analyzed by many different groups around the world, all achieving the same conclusion, that unless we put something in, we cannot explain the universe the way it is. And if you go to a conference on cosmology and you listen to talks by the leaders in this field, you will find that the consensus view is that the stuff we're made of, atoms, only contribute to about 4% of the total budget of the universe. So we belong to a minority. We are a rather unimportant minority when it comes to percentage. And then 21% or so is in the form of dark matter. And we need to add an extra component, an unexplained component, which we dub dark energy, which is about 75%. So we live in a universe where we don't understand 96% of it, which is very disturbing. 21% dark matter, 75% dark energy. So the question is, what is it? And apart from the possibility there are some unknown fields in the universe, people refer to them as scalar fields, for example, that may manifest themselves as dark energy, there's other people, like the authors of this paper, who say, instead of invoking an extra component, let's just change the rules of the game and say that we modify the underlying theory. In this particular case, they say that if you use Einstein's theory, you can write distances in a different way. And in their interpretation, which has still to be checked carefully, then you don't need to put this extra component. There are other groups who say, let's even be more radical than that and actually tweak Einstein's theory and modify certain terms there to look differently. And in doing so, again, let's get rid of dark energy, but modify the underlying theory. So if you like to put it in a more heuristic way, you have either to accept that there is a certain substance, if you like, maybe the modern ether, though it may not do good publicity calling it this way, modern ether, there's some scalar field everywhere, including in your cup of tea, including... It's both on Earth as well as everywhere in the universe, and it's just there. Or you can say, look, the theory by which we interpret the observation is just incomplete, and we need to tweak it, which is what this paper has done, other papers have done. Other papers suggest that maybe we live inside in a big void, so our position in the universe is not characteristic. All these ideas are very intriguing.
Chris, I know that Ofo is your supervisor. Do you have a question?
Yes, well, you should never pass up the opportunity to ask questions of your ex-supervisor. Hi, Ofo.
And even to contradict your former supervisor.
Well, I'm not going to contradict you. I wanted to ask about one of those projects, because I know that you're in charge of a UK group that joined a project called the Dark Energy Survey.
That's right.
That was happening when I was at UCL, but things must have been pretty far advanced. How's DES going?
The main tool is to actually use a telescope in Chile, which already exists. It's actually an existing telescope, and to upgrade it. And my colleagues in UCL are actually putting together that optical system. In fact, large lenses, one of them is actually 1 meter across. Five lenses, one of them is 1 meter across, arguably one of the biggest in the world, are being polished in the south of France. And eventually they will come to our basement in central London, be put together and shipped to Chile, and together with our international collaborators, we'll modernize this telescope, and it will start there fairly soon, in 2011, that's fairly soon in terms of those big projects. This survey will map 300 million galaxies, I repeat it, 300 million galaxies, using these galaxies, the way they are distributed in space, the way they are clustered, and also the way their images are distorted, we'll be able to say more about dark energy or alternatives. The reason for that is that in a universe with or without dark energy, the patterns of galaxies will look different. Or in a universe with or without dark energy, the images, distant images, will get distorted different amounts.
That's great news. It sounds really exciting. We've got bated breath and fingers crossed. Thank you very much for talking to us, Ofer.
Thank you.
That was Professor Ofer Lahav, Head of Astrophysics at University College London. And if you want to talk more about dark energy, either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can also sign up to our Twitter feeds. Search for Science Weekly or Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
So back to you, Chris. We'll cover other bits since we've got you here. Ofer was talking about one dark energy project, and we are also keeping an eye on the LHC at the moment, which is due to spark up again in November. Are you expecting great stuff from the LHC?
Absolutely. I mean, particle physicists deserve their once every 20 years experiment, and LHC is really exciting. From an astronomy point of view, it's not dark energy it will help us with. It's the other missing component that Ofer mentioned.
It's the dark matter.
Dark matter, this 20-something percent of the universe that has gravity but doesn't interact with light. What we want from the LHC is a whole suite of massive neutral particles that could be the stuff that the universe is made of. So I think particle physicists are pretty confident that those particles might exist. And so for us, we'd like to know what the universe is made of. If they don't find anything, then we start going back to theories and tweaking things to see if we can get rid of dark matter as well as dark energy. But that gets very tricky, because then you've got to turn one knob to fix galaxy formation without breaking our view of the early universe, without affecting the fact that the solar system works pretty well with our current theories. It all becomes very, very difficult indeed.
You referred to it as a sort of pinball table of trying to keep it.
That's right. And I was never very good at those things with the four handles.
Adding different knobs and tweaking different things.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you also about another great, well, experiment in the old classic sense that's coming up on Friday. LCROSS is about to smash about 3 tons of material into the moon, isn't it?
That's right, and it should be said this is deliberate. So this is a suicidal little NASA spacecraft that's going to hit the south pole of the moon. But before LCROSS itself hits, something about the size of a bus, the top stage of the rocket that got it and its sister spacecraft to the moon, will hit a crater at the south pole called Kobayus. And the reason they're doing this is that they think there might be large deposits of water hidden at the bottom of these cold craters. So the temperature down there is about -240°C. The sun never lights up the floor, so they think water might build up there. And if that's true, we can go and provide rocket fuel, because hydrogen and oxygen is rocket fuel, and stuff to drink for astronauts. So we want to know if it's there. They're going to hit with the rocket, and then this little plucky LCROSS spacecraft will fly through the debris, take measurements, and hit the surface about 3 minutes later.
What time's it going to happen? Will we actually be able to see it?
Yes, from the UK, in UK time, British summer time, it's 12:30, just after lunch, so it is daytime. But if you go out and look for the moon, you will see it about 15 degrees above the western horizon. So what you want to do is stand in the shadow of a building, because you want to make sure you cannot get the sun in your binoculars or
right.
telescope. It's very dangerous.
Yeah,
you don't want to burn your retina. So make sure the sun's out the way. Look around the western horizon with your binoculars. Any binoculars will do. You'll see the moon, and just watch. And you might see the plume. If the predictions are right, you should see not the explosion itself, but the plume of material that's thrown up should catch the sun and glitter rather prettily. So you should definitely try and have a look.
And why don't you tell us one more time the address for Galaxy Zoo, in case anyone's fancying getting involved.
We need your help for galaxies. We've also got a hunt for supernovae, exploding stars, starting this week. So if you'd like to go to www.galaxyzoo.org, all help gratefully received.
It sounds brilliant. Thank you very much, Chris. It's been great having you this week. That was Dr. Chris Lintott. And also here was the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, Sam Wong also helped out, and I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening. Oh, and next week, Alok's back. He's already lowering the tone. It's all about penisology with Ed Sykes. We kid you not. There's a few other options too, including something potentially even ruder, but we'll have to run it past the boss first.